Good morning. Today's daf in Baba Kama is Pei Gimel. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is learned Lezecher Nishmas Liba Gabriela Bashmuel. We are in Pei Beis and Beis. We are wrapping up today the seventh parak of Baba Kama. A particularly long parak in the Masechta dealing with Geneva, with the laws of theft, and the last Mishnayos in the last couple dapim of the parak dealt primarily with institutionalized takanot gezeiros that were made by chachamim in order to make sure that we do not steal from one another. So it brought us to then have a discussion regarding 10 takanot that were made by Yehoshua ben Nun. That really takes us back to daf Pei Aleph. Pei Beis, yesterday's daf, dealt with the takanot that were instituted by Ezra when he came into Eretz Yisrael some 900 plus years later after Yehoshua. And as long as we're on the topic of lists and the number 10, so we are continuing now in the Gemara from where we left off yesterday, towards the top of the Amud Pei Beis Amud Beis, and we are starting today with Asar Dvarim Nemru B'Yerushalayim. There are 10 things that were said regarding the city of Yerushalayim. Ein Habayis Chalut Ba. You do not have a house that is sold indefinitely in the city of Yerushalayim. Take a look at Rashi over here. Kedim Bat Yerei Choma. Generally speaking, when you have a walled city, Yerushalayim is the quintessential walled city. When you have a walled city, so the sales of houses and properties in a walled city goes as follows. Generally speaking, in Eretz Yisrael, you do not sell land, you lease land. And what's going to happen is that by the oval year, it's going to return back to the original owner. That's generally speaking how property works in Eretz Yisrael. In a walled city, so the halacha is that you sell a piece of property, you sell a house, and then the original seller has 1 year to buy it back. If he does not buy it back within the 1 year, so then it is sold indefinitely. This is the halachas of Bat Yerei Choma. So you have the halachas of Eretz Yisrael in general, you have the halachas of a walled city, and then you have Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim being the exception to the rule, where there is no indefinite sales in Yerushalayim. Take a look at Rashi over here. Rashi explains why should that be. It basically follows the pattern of Eretz Yisrael, meaning that it will, there's always a chance to buy back, meaning it's a lease, it's not a sale, and in Yovel it is going to be returned back to the original owner. Why should that be? So stay tuned, the Gemara is going to discuss that. Number two, Eina Mavia Egla Rufa. The city of Yerushalayim is never going to be responsible for the bringing of an Egla Rufa, even if there's a body that's found within proximity of Yerushalayim. The city and the council of Yerushalayim is not responsible for Egla Rufa, again, for the why of the matter. Stay tuned, the Gemara is going to discuss. Number three, Eino Nasis Yer Nidachas. It will never be subject to the laws of Yer Nidachas if the majority of a city is observing idolatry, is worshipping idolatry. So then you have a special label for the entire city. It's called Yer Nidachas. It's kind of hard to fathom, but if the city of Yerushalayim is occupied by mostly idolaters, the laws of Yer Nidachas are not in force. Again, we'll get to the why later. Number four, Nematama Benegaim, it's not subject to Tumas Negaim. If there is houses in Yerushalayim that have the discoloration that would make it a Tzaras house, simply not subject to the laws of Tzaras. In other words, it's not a Nega. The Ein Motzian Bo Zizim V'Guzis Trust, there are no protrusions, no balconies, no protrusions in Yerushalayim. Again, we'll get to why later on. Einosim Ba Ashpasos. No garbages are to be there's no trash allowed in Yerushalayim. Einos ba kivshanos, you're not allowed to make ovens. So the zoning restrictions in Yerushalayim is such that you can't have ovens in your working ovens. You cannot add any type of garden or orchards other than the ones that were instituted by the early Nevi'im. So there's no rezoning of Yerushalayim. Ein megalim batanagolim. You cannot raise chickens in Yerushalayim. This is something that we already tackled earlier. The reason why is because we want Yerushalayim to be a tumah-free environment. And chickens are carriers of tumah. I don't mean infection. I don't mean bacteria. I mean actual tumah. We discussed this earlier. What the chickens do is they take a sheretz, they put it in their mouth, and they carry it from place to place. And that's fine in general. We don't want that in Yerushalayim. People are eating karbanos in Yerushalayim. Ein malin ba'as ames. You cannot do halanos ames. You cannot leave a body overnight in Yerushalayim. If somebody dies, you bury the body immediately. There are occasions where the halacha demands that you are to leave the body out. In Yerushalayim, that is not even allowed even for a moment. Just as an interesting parenthetical note, anyone who has ever been to a burial in Yerushalayim or have anything to do with burial in Yerushalayim, so nowadays, I don't know if there's a connection between the minhag nowadays and what we just learned in the Gemara, but nowadays they bury immediately, even if at night, they bury at night as well. Ein habayis chalut ba. Okay, so after giving the list of 10 things that are applicable specific to Yerushalayim, so the Gemara now is going to give the reasons why. You know, when I say why, I don't really mean the Gemara is going to give rationale. And svar, the Gemara is going to give psukim. And so to explain what the source, what the basis of the halacha is. So let's go step by step. The Ein Habayis Chalut Ba. No, there's no definitive sales of houses in Yerushalayim. The sales of houses in Yerushalayim are all leases. So why should that be? Dechziv v'kama bayis ha-shalo chama litzmi sus. Lakona Osav Ladarosav. So the Torah, when describing the sale of the house in the walled city, says that it will be an indefinite sale. The Kasav Lanishalk Yushalam Shvatim. Our Bryce is of the opinion. This is a controversial statement of the Gemara. I say controversial meaning that not everyone agrees to this. But our Bryce is of the opinion that Yushalam was not divided amongst the Shvatim. So it is, I'll use the American model to describe it. It's a pretty good way to describe it. It is federal property. Yerushalayim is not divided amongst the Shvatim. It's federal property. And so therefore, the only time that you have this halacha of definitive sales is only on property that's owned by a Shevet. But if you have a property that's not owned by a Shevet, if you have this quote-unquote federal property of Yerushalayim, so therefore, there's no such thing as definitive sales. Everything is done via lease. Anybody via Egla Rufa up to the second halacha of Yerushalayim. There's no Egla Rufa. The pasuk says, "Ki matzeh halal ba'damah she Hashem alachecha nosin lach l'rishtah v'yishalayim nonschal kol shvatim." Again, the pasuk indicates that the only city responsible to bring the Egla Rufa are those cities that are owned by a shevet, since Yerushalayim is federal property. So once again, not subject to Egla Rufa. Number three, in Onasis Yerani Dachas, it does not become Yerani Dachas. Dechsev arecha. The Torah, when describing the parsha of Egla Rufa, uses the word "your cities" and again possessive. Yerushalayim nos chalkal shvatim. Okay, and again, same basic idea. Yerushalayim is federal property. And eino matame b'negayim, not subject to mas negayim. Dechsiv nasati nega tzaras bebeis eretz achuzas chem. It's a theme alert. Okay, it has to be that the tzaras is on a house that's on your property, on your real estate. You cannot have any protrusions coming out of your houses in the city of Yerushalayim. So here the Gemara gives two explanations why that should be. Number one, says the Gemara, because once you have a protrusion, so that creates a roof. And once you have a roof, so you have possibilities and a chance of the spreading of Tumas Ohel. Once I'm underneath a roof together shared by a mace, so I become Tame. So basically, how do you avoid that in Yerushalayim? Don't make roofs, meaning obviously you make houses, but don't have protrusions coming out of the house, because that will effectively make a roof, and then you're going to be spreading Tumas Ohel in the event that there's a body, a dead body, underneath the same roof. Additionally, says the Gemara, second reason why no protrusions is because we want the traffic flow in Yerushalayim to be as free as possible. We want traffic to move. And therefore, any protrusions will be an impediment to traffic. And in Yerushalayim, obviously, when you have a lila rego, so you want people to be able to move around Yerushalayim. You cannot make garbage dungs, heaps in Yerushalayim. And the Gemara says, because that's a place where there are shkatzim. And shkatzim are a source of tuma. And again, we want Yerushalayim to be a tuma free environment. You do not make ovens because ovens produce smoke. And what's wrong with smoke? So Rashi says, so what the smoke does is it blackens the walls and it takes away from the beauty of Yerushalayim. So therefore, no industrial ovens in Yerushalayim. And in terms of the gardens, in terms of the pardesim, so the reason why is because sircha. There's some bad and foul-smelling grass. So therefore, any orchards that already exist in Yerushalayim, that's fine, but you can add on to that. In terms of the chickens, we discussed it before. The Gemara repeats it again. The chickens are carriers of Tumah, and people are eating karban in Yerushalayim. And finally, Ein Malin and Bas Ames, you do not do Halanas Ames in Yerushalayim, meaning even if there is an occasion where we're supposed to leave the body out just a little bit, we do not do so in Yerushalayim. The Gemara to this gives a very simple one-word explanation why that should be. The Gemara says Gemara. Now the Gemara is not making a self-reference. When the Gemara says the word Gemara, it means it's a tradition. Rashi over here says exactly that. Misarisi biadina ve'in tam ladavar. So this is simply a tradition, and we do not know the reason why that should be. But the we have the tradition. Okay. We are now going back to the Mishnah, which is going to wrap up our perek. The Mishnah says that you cannot raise pigs in Yerushalayim. No. I just conflated the previous Gemara with the Gemara we're doing right now. You cannot raise pigs in general in Eretz Yisrael, Tanur Rabbanan. Kishitzar beis chashmonai zel zeh. When the Chashmonaim house were quarreling with one another. We know that sometime during the middle of by chain of the Second Temple, so you had Greek oppression, and then we had a revolution. The revolution was started by a group of Kohanim known as the Chashmonaim. I think we're all familiar with the story, right? Leads to the miracle of the Chashmonaim defeating the Greeks and Hanukkah. Right, that we all knew. Perhaps what is less popular is the idea that not only did the Chashmonaim defeat the Greeks, but they also assumed the Melucha. They became the kings. Now, generally speaking, we have a very strong belief in, and I'm taking this out of context, but a separation of church and state, meaning that we want the Kohanim to be the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, and then we want the kings to come from Shevet Yehuda. And we want that to be separate. And that's the way the Torah designed it. What the Chashmonaim did is they did both. They were Kohanim, they're born Kohanim, and on top of that, they also took control of the Melucha as well. The one most notably critical of this is the Ramban. You take a look at the Ramban in Chumash and Parshas Vayeshev. So the Ramban is critical of the Chashmonaim for doing so. In the later generation of the Chashmonaim dynasty, so there was internal strife between the families, and they had a hard time deciding who was going to be the king. So that's what the Braisa here is describing. So we are now towards the end of Bayis Sheni, and we are in a standoff between two members of the Chashmonaim family. And that's what the Braisa is describing. So we had Horkanus in the inside and Aristobulus on the outside. Just the built-in irony that these are the Chashmonaim who defeated the Greeks, and meanwhile they have Greek names. But now they had a Beis HaMikdash and they brought the carbon tamid, and basically every day, because of a siege that was set around the city, so they had to sneak in sheep, goat, in order to bring the carbon tamid. And so they would basically lift the animal over the wall. Now there was a Chacham there, and he knew Chachmas Yavanis. He knew, now I'll say Greek philosophy. It may not be the best way to describe it, but some sort of Greek wisdom, Greek scholarship. So he says, you're trying to lay a siege on the city. However, the real heart of the Jewish people and what's causing their longevity is the idea that they're offering a carbon tamid in the Beis HaMikdash daily. And so if you could stop the supply line of the carbon tamid, then you're going to get to the Jews. So the next day, so they found where the exchange takes place between the money, the people on the inside, the people on the outside. People on the inside gave money. People on the outside smuggled in the animal. They found that point, and v'halu lahem chazir. And instead of bringing in a goat that was fit for carbon tamid, so what they did is they replaced the goat with a pig. Now the pig, aside from being a non-kosher animal, it goes without saying, it's obvious that the pig is not suitable for a carbon. And then we know that pig is really the prototype of non-kosher animals, even though a pig is just as not kosher as any other non-kosher animal, but the pig becomes the prototype. So, such powerful, strong imagery. The pig is being hoisted over the wall. As it gets halfway up the wall, the pig sticks its nails into the wall as if to stop itself from being put over the wall, and the land of Israel shaking to its core. All 400 parsa by 400 parsa, that's the total area, square foot area of Eretz Yisrael, is shaking. And as a reaction to this incident, so two people were cursed. Number one, anyone who grows pigs. Meaning, why are there pigs all together in Eretz Yisrael? Because somebody's farming pigs in Eretz Yisrael. So a curse given to those people who are farming pigs in Eretz Yisrael. And additional to that, another curse for those people who are engaged in Chachmas Yevanis, as the person who was knowledgeable in Chachmas Yevanis, so he understood how to really get at the Jews. And the Gemara says, and if you want to just put a timeline together, you could at the same time plot in your timeline the incident of where the Omer needs to be brought from Ganos Srifim and the Shtei Alechem needs to be brought from Bikas Ein Socher. Generally speaking, the Karban Omer was a barley offering, and the barley was produced from a field that was proximate to Yerushalayim. There was one year, the Gemara described elsewhere in Menachos, where they couldn't get it from close, they had to get it from far away. The details, I don't remember all the details right now, but the Gemara in Menachos goes over exactly what happened. And so they had to get the barley offering from a distance. Furthermore, the Shtei Alechem, which was offered 50 days later on Shavuos, so the Shtei Alechem also was offered from an unusual location called the Valley of Ein Socher, name of a place. Anyway, the Gemara is just simply saying that those two events coordinated with our event that we're describing right over here. It occurred sometime toward the end of Bayit Sheni. Obviously, there's a reason why the Gemara is plotting these points together. Off the top of my head, I don't have an explanation why that should be, but okay, they all belong together. Next, we are on the very bottom of Pei Beis Amud Beis v'Chachmas Yevanis Miasiri. Now, the Gemara says, "Curse for the person who's involved in Chachmas Yevanis." The Gemara says, "V'atanya, I'm a Rebbe. Be'eretz Yisrael, Lashon Sursi, Lama, Oh, Lashon Hakodesh, Oh, Lashon Yevanis." So, Rebbe was very critical of Lashon Sursi. He did not like the fact that people spoke Aramaic in Eretz Yisrael. It's a simple observation that they spoke Aramaic in Eretz Yisrael, meaning even during the entirety of Bayit Sheni, during the Second Temple period. So the language that was spoken was Aramaic. Rebbe was critical about it. Now, I could provide simple evidence that Rebbe was not a fan of Aramaic, as when he penned the Torah Sheba'al Peh, right, he was the first one who committed the Torah Sheba'al Peh to organized writing, so he wrote it in Lashon HaKodesh. He wrote in Hebrew. He did not write in Aramaic. Now, I'll also point out that a couple generations later, when they wrote the Talmud Yerushalmi, meaning same Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, just a short couple generations later, so they wrote the Talmud Yerushalmi in Aramaic. It's a different dialect of Aramaic than the one that we're used to in the Bavli, but they wrote in Aramaic. So this criticism of Rebbe did not seem to be a ubiquitous, it was not a consensus that everyone was so critical of the Aramaic, but Rebbe was. So he says, Oh, Lashon HaKodesh, Oh, Lashon Yevanis. He says, listen, you want to speak Hebrew, that's fine. You want to speak Greek, that's also fine as well. He was happy with either one of the languages. He was not happy with Aramaic. Interesting, why was he not happy with the Aramaic language? That part's not clear, but he was certainly okay with Yevanis. What we are now trying to figure out is, wait one second, we just said that curses the person who engages in Chachmas Yevanis. And Rebbe was totally comfortable with the Greek language. And I guess we can also point out that we learned together the Gemara Megillah. We know that there's an opinion in the Gemara Megillah that says you can even write a Sefer Torah in the Greek language. So clearly there was not a disdain for the Greek language. In fact, just the opposite. They liked the Greek language. V'amar Rav Yossi, Bava Lashon Arami, Lama. O Lashon HaKodesh, O Lashon Parsi. And Rav Yossi had a similar critique about Bava. Bava, why are we speaking Aramaic? You can either speak Lashon HaKodesh or you can speak Farsi. But the Aramaic language, you also didn't understand that as well. So, okay, the Gemara kind of just skirts around the criticism of Rebbe on Aramaic and Rav Yossi on the Aramaic language. And meanwhile, we clearly engage in the Limud HaTorah in mostly Aramaic. Okay, put that aside, and we're basically in the middle of a question. How can we curse someone who's involved in Chachmas Yevanis when clearly Rebbe was in favor of Chachmas Yevanis? Of Lashon Yevanis, and that really is the answer. Amre, they said, Pei Gimel Amad Aleph, three lines down. They, when presented this question, gave the following answer. Lashon Yevani Lachod, Chachmas Yevani Lachod. So the Gemara says we're going to make a distinction between the language, the Greek language, versus Greek wisdom. Greek wisdom / philosophy, that's something that we should not engage in. And that is where the curse lies. But in terms of the Greek language itself, the Greek language is fine and condoned. And some people even prefer. Read a couple weeks ago. So Elof Yeladim Hayu Bebeis Abba. There were 1,000 children in my father's house. Chamesh Meos Mehem Lamdu Torah. Chamesh Meos Lamdu Chachmas Yevanis. 500 of them learned Torah. 500 of them were engaged in Chachmas Yevanis. V'lanishtar Mehem Ela Ani Kan Uvenachi Abba Beasya. And of those who survived, only two survived. So the Gemara says, Amri Shani Beis Rabban Gamliel Shayu Krovim LaMalchus. So the Gemara says, yeah, as far as Rabban Gamliel is concerned, so they were Krovim LaMalchus. They had a very close connection, relationship with the Roman government, and so therefore they engaged in the study of Chachmas Yevanis. So basically a unique family, politically connected, they learned Chachmas Yevanis. The Gemara quotes a Braisa, Mesaper, Kome Hare Zemi Darche Amori. If you get a certain kind of haircut, it is an Emirate practice, meaning should not be done. It's a violation of the prohibition of Vechukosem. Lo se lechu, you shouldn't walk in their ways. However, Avtumos bar Reuven hitira lo lesaper kumi mimishu karv lamachus. However, Avtumos was close to the Roman government, and so therefore he was given a special dispensation where he can get this kind of haircut. Shalbeis Rabban Gamliel hitira lahem lesaper bechachmas Yevanis, and for the family of Rabban Gamliel, the house of Rabban Gamliel, they spoke chachmas Yevanis mimishu karv lamachus, again because they're close to the king. Okay, just as a very interesting note, the Gemara doesn't explain how the dispensation worked. Meaning, if we're talking about an Issa Daraisa, now Chachmas Yevanis, right? Hard to call that an Issa Daraisa. You should learn Chachmas Yevanis. It's a ban. It's a ban. And my best guess would be that probably the ban is based on the fact that Chachmas Yevanis draws people away from Yadus. It draws people away from Judaism and from authentic Torah Judaism. So it's a ban. But the Emirate haircut, where there it's a Torah violation of Chukosam Lo Selechu, it's an Emirate practice and we're not allowed to follow their practices. So how does being close to the Roman politic, how does that provide for you a dispensation? So that in of itself becomes an interesting discussion. I just raise it, but we're gonna move on. Loigado Adam es a kelev ela in king kashur bishal shalos. A person should not have a dog unless it is chained. Tana Rabbanan lo yigad adam azekel avela im kain kashu b'shal shalos, unless you have a leash on it. Ava megad dohu bi'ir asmucha l'separ. However, if you live in a border town, so then have the dogs around. Right, you live in a border town, that is a dangerous place to be. You are right on the border of Eretz Yisrael, you are literally the front line. And so therefore, you want to have a dog around and help protect you, that's fine. V'kashu b'yoma matir b'layla, tied up during the day, but untied at night. Tanya Rabbi Lazar Agadol Omer HaMagadol Klavim K'Magadol Chazirin. Rabbi Lazar Agadol says, you raise dogs in your house, it's like raising pigs. L'may nafkamina, l'mekam alah ba'arur. Just like a curse was instituted for those people who are raising pigs, so similarly as well, there's a curse for someone who raises dogs. So you see a lot of conflicting comments in the Gemara regarding whether or not the Gemara was an advocate of dog ownership or not. I'm Rav Yossi Bar Minyumin. Before we go on in the Gemara, just Just a very interesting aside. The go back to Pei Beis Amud Beis. Just it's, in general, it's a good thing to know. And that is, if you look at the third to last Tosus on the Amud, so we have a special ban about raising pigs. And curses the one who raises pigs, and we just went over it not once but twice today in today's Gemara, that there's a curse for those who raise pigs. Take a look at the third to last Tosus on the Amud on Pei Beis Amud Beis. Lo yigado adam chazirin v'im tomar. Tosos raises the following difficulty. Tosos quotes a Mishnah in Shvius, and that is Ein osin schora benevelos utrefos. So one is in general is not allowed to make a business, a livelihood, out of selling non kosher food. Now, just as this part's interesting. Non-kosher food is asur b'achila. You're not allowed to eat non-kosher food. But mutar b'hana. You're allowed to get benefit from non-kosher food. So in other words, if you have non-kosher food, the only real restriction, prohibition in the Torah is to eat it. But you're allowed to get benefit from it. This is a rabbinic institution. This is a rabbinic takana that even though you're allowed to get benefit, and benefit of course means you're allowed to profit from it. Profiting is benefiting. Even though you're allowed to profit from it, but you can't make your main livelihood from the sale of nevels and trefos. Perikol Shah Nami Omer Tzadi Chai Va'ofshin is damnu amini tameim dafkan is damnu avalech achil alo. In fact, the Gemara in Pesachim Tosfos brings down says that let's say you set up your nets and you're looking to trap animals, and it happens to be that a non-kosher animal gets into your net. That's fine. Meaning you could take the non-kosher animal, you could sell it. But that's only in the event that it happens to get into your net. But what you can't do is you can't specifically hunt after non-kosher animals and make your livelihood out of the sale of non-kosher animals. Okay, so there are a number of sources. And basically, Tosfos is bothered by a really simple question. Once we have the Mishnah and Shvi, the Gemara and Pesachim, he quotes the Torah's Kohanim, a Sifra as well. You have all these sources that speak to the idea that you're not, in general, allowed to make your livelihood out of non-kosher animals. So what is their Gemara telling us over here? Oh, by the way, curses is somebody who's involved in the industry of pig farming. Shouldn't that fall under the general prohibition? So, v'tirtz rabbeinatam d'hayna dafka b'davar ha'omed la'achila. Aval imagal alim shoch oros b'shamnan olamach le'yisosh shimshach mehem sharei. Very interesting answer, rabbeinatam. Rabbeinatam says that the general ban of not making an industry out of non-kosher is only if it's sold for the purposes of consumption, of eating. But if you deal in non-kosher animals, but not for consumption, but let's say you're making soap out of it, you're making glue out of it, Rabbeinu Tam says, then you do not have the general ban. So you want to start a glue company out of horses? Rabbeinu Tam says, that's fine. A Jew could do that. The only prohibition is if you are making a business and where the consumer is going to be eating the non-kosher animal. And so that's why what our Gemara is introducing is that when it comes to pig, all commercial activity with pig is prohibited. That's Rabbeinu Tam's answer. It's not the only answer to resolve this issue, but just a good idea to know, a good piece of information to know in terms of the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. Okay, we're on Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. We're more than halfway down on the Amud. We're talking about bordering cities. So we said that in a border town, even though it's not preferred that you have a dog, an unleashed dog, but if you live in a border town, so then you can have dogs. It's good for your protection. During the day, leash them up, but at night, let them go, and they'll be great in terms of protecting you and your family. Amar Rav Yosef, Bar Min Yumi, Amar Rav Nachman, Bechol Ir, sorry, Bavel Ki'ir Asmuchel Esfar Dami. So in terms of the Babylonian city in general, so it is like a city that is close to the border, meaning Babylon's just not the safest of places. And so therefore, just like there's a special dispensation, where you can have an unleashed dog, so same thing is true in Bavel. Just so also another interesting note, Rashi. Rashi over here says that Bavel, generally speaking, is a term that we describe the provincial area of Bavel, but here Rashi says we're speaking specifically about a particular town in Bavel. Rashi writes, Bavel, Shema Medina, V'yirecha Shabbat Nikras Nahardav, Oso Ir Smucha Lesfar. Rashi says that we're describing specifically the city of Narada. Vashmina Rav Nachman, the whole Yesh Babavel, Yishuv Kavua V'Yisrael Harbei, Mutal Agado Klavim B'Iras Mukhal Esfar, Ki'ilu Himer Tishal. So Rashi says that we're talking specifically about this town of Narada. Good historical piece of information to know. The town of Narada did not last. Right after Shmuel ends his term of being the Rosh Yeshiva, he dies. So the city of Narada is the where Shmuel was the Marda Asra. He was the head of Narada. The city of Narada fell into died as a Jewish community, and it was the cities of Sur and Pambadisa, which had very long lasting historical endurance, but not the city, not the town of Narada. Okay, back to our Gemara. So, Hasmech Lesmar, Dami Tirgaman, Narada. Sorry, the Gemara says it. I quoted Rashi. The Gemara says that's the town of Narada. Darash Rav Dustai Demin Biri. Uvenucha Yomar, Shuv Hashem Revos Afa Yisrael. Should be able to pronounce it correctly. Lamdecha She'in Shechina Shara Ayisua Pachos Mishne Alafim Vishne Revavos. Shne Revavos. So the Gemara tells us that when you have Shechina, Shechina is, you'll feel the Shechina when you have 22,000 Jews. How do we arrive at the number 22,000? So you go back to the pasuk. The pasuk says, "Rivavos alfei Yisrael." Rivavos, a rivavah is 10,000. So 10,000 is one rivavah. Two of them is 20,000, and then alfei Yisrael. So again, that's another 2,000. Elif is 1,000. Alfei is 2,000. So that gets us to the number of 22,000. So the Gemara says, "Chaser achas va'isa ishem uberes b'neim v'ruy le'shlim v'novach ba'kelavi pila nimsa zegaron l'shchina shetistalach mi'israel." Let's say you have 21,999 Jews, of one of them being a pregnant woman, and then, God forbid, but let's say she gets scared by a dog, she miscarries. So now, originally, we counted the fetus as one of the 22,000, which in of itself is interesting in terms of. You know, it's the right. It's a fetus. It's not a. It's not yet born. But in terms of this accounting, for this kind of accounting, the fetus works in terms of presenting Shechina. The Gemara is just simply making a point that look at the possible effects of a dog, where a dog is going to take away the Shechina by causing the miscarriage. The Gemara is just simply speaking to what could be one of the calamities of having a dog. And in general, just it's good to try to understand that we have ten Jews and we have the Shechina, meaning that makes a minion. But over here, it must be that 22,000 provides an extra degree, an extra level of Hashras Shechina.
Now, why is recruiting women?
I mean, if we're talking about pregnant women, the answer is clearly yes. Yeah, but again, this is for this kind of hashra shechina. Okay, hahi isasa da'alta lamefa ba'u beisa. A woman was baking bread. She goes into the house in order to bake bread. Navach bakava. A dog barks at her. Amarla amari lo tistafe mine shkula nive. So the owner says, "Oh, this line. I've heard this line so many times. Oh, don't be scared. Yeah, right? It's a gentle creature. It's fine." Now, again, by the way, I told you, I'm fine with dogs. I'm perfectly good with dogs. So, but I see, in our environment, in our community, I've seen a lot of people who are just terrified of dogs. So so the owner said, and by the way, I took the canines out. In other words, he doesn't have teeth anymore. Do not worry. So the woman said, "Oh, thank you very much." And I say that with dripping sarcasm. She was not thankful. She was not appreciative. She said, literally, take all your good and throw it behind you, because the child already moved, meaning that this woman was a pregnant woman. She got scared as a result of the barking dog, and she miscarried, and obviously a tragedy. And the fact that, you know, the owner removed the teeth of the animal didn't help her in that particular situation. In Porsin Nishman Leonim, you can't set up a trap for birds unless you are at a certain distance away. This is the last point we made in the Mishnah. This is where we're ending the parak today. The reason being is that when you set up a net and you trap birds, you're going to be trapping birds that are owned by your neighbor. Now, we already discussed this back in the Mishnah. Ownership of birds is kind of a dicey, it's a dicey discussion, because you have a birdhouse, and birds congregate in your birdhouse. That doesn't make you the owner of the birds. It just simply means that you have a point of congregation of birds on your house. But you think they're yours, for good reason. They're on your property. And what's going to happen now is that if you have somebody who's close by, who's luring the birds away and capturing the birds, so you and him are going to have fights. And so therefore, to try to minimize the amount of fights, so we're basically saying to people, you want to set up a trap. In order to trap birds, make sure you're far enough away from other people's properties so that you and him don't come to blows over whose birds they are. The Gemara says, Vatana. Now, in terms of the distance, so our Mishnah set the distance at... I should remember this. Right, it was measured in a ris, 30 ris. Okay, and Rashi converts that for us. It's arba milin, 4 mil, approximately 4 kilometers. Okay, the Gemara says v'atanan. So marchikin es hashavach min ha'ir chamishamama. So the Gemara notes that we have another Gemara in Baba Basra that sets it at 50 amas. 50 amas is considerably less than 4 mil. Every mil is 2,000 amma. So 4 of them is 8,000 amma. And so that is way off from what the Gemara in Baba Basra, the Mishnah Baba Basra, that sets it at 50 amas. Amar Abai Meshashayti Tuvei Karsaihu B'chamishim Amma Malya Omeshin Shoshin Ris. So the Gemara says, well, it goes like this. That in terms of them going and pecking for food, so they're full already by 50 amma. So in terms of the birds going out and pecking and eating, so all you need is the 50 amma distance in order to be safe. However, after that, in terms of them flying, hovering around, scouting, so they're going to go much more than 50 amas. But in terms of not eating in other people's properties, 50 amas is all. Vesulo, the Gemara says, V'atanya b'yishav afilo me'amil, lo yifras. Now, the Gemara says if it's an inhabited area, so then even 100 mil is not going to be a good enough distance. So Rav Yosef Amar, b'yishav krumim. So Rav says, well, when we're talking about Yishuv, we mean vineyards. And what the birds will do is basically look at the vineyard as a station. And so what the bird will go is from station to station. So once you have a community, some sort of development where you have multiple vineyards, so then the birds will be hopping from vineyard to vineyard. And so therefore, any trap that you set up is going to lead to fighting, because the birds can fly at great distances. Rabba Amar B'Yishuv Shovchim. So Rabba says we're talking about a development that has a lot of bird's nests. So again, it's the same basic idea. The bird's going to be going from station to station, and therefore the bird's going to be going at some distance. So the Gemara says, well, the second answer really doesn't help us, because you're not allowed to set up a trap within a certain proximity of a birdhouse. So if we're talking about a development where there are multiple birdhouses, well, you can't set it up even far away because of the multiple birdhouses. The Gemara says that answer is really not good, because you have multiple birdhouses, meaning regardless of where the bird is coming from, whether this is the first station, the fourth station, the tenth station, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, you're setting up your trap within proximity of a birdhouse. So, So the Gemara says we can give multiple answers to this. Maybe the birdhouse is owned by a non-Jew. Maybe the birdhouse is Hefker. Nobody owns it. Maybe the birdhouse is your very own birdhouse. So now that we've set up the birdhouse as not belonging to another Jew, so now we understand. So are you stealing from another Jew? The answer is no. Not, at least not from that particular birdhouse. However, because it's a birdhouse, it allows birds from other birdhouses to use this birdhouse as a station. And so therefore, that's why you can't set up a trap even close to this birdhouse, because it may be just simply a stopping point for a bird from a different birdhouse. Hajjal Lacham Ruba, that is the end of the seventh parak of the Masechta. Let's begin this morning the eighth parak. In terms of the sequence of the Masechta, so a little bit strange. I say that for the following reason. In the first through six chapters of Baba Kama, so we discussed Hezek. We discussed damages. And we talked about property damage. We talked about your property damaging other property. We talked about your property damaging other people. And then for the seventh parak, which was a long parak in the Masechta, almost 20 blad of Gemara. So in the seventh parak, we talked about Geneva. We talked about theft. And then the eighth parak, we return back to damages. Damages inflicted by one person to another. So this is Nizke Adam Ba'adam. People damaging other people. So in terms of the organization, it seems a little bit strange where we take a break in the Masechta talking about Geneva, and then we return back to damages. Okay, so obviously Rabbi Yehuda Anasi had some sort of design when he set up the prakim in this manner. What exactly is the intent of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi? So I don't have a great explanation as of today. Hopefully in the future, the next time we get through this Masechta, I'll have a good explanation why that should be. Sorry. Raised a question I don't know the answer to. Okay. Now, we touched on this earlier in the Masechta, but this is it. This parak, the eighth parak of Baba Kama, deals with exactly the payments that one has to pay when one person damages another person. So if you inflict your friend with damages, so you have to pay five specific types of payments. Number one, you have to pay nezek, you have to pay the actual damage itself. So in other words, you base him on what his market value is, and you look at what his market value was versus what his market value is, and because of the damage, let's say you lopped off a hand of his, right, a really unpleasant damage that you've done to the person, but now the person has a depreciated value, so you have to pay that. That is not payment number one. Number two, tsar. You have to pay for the pain. We're going to give a formula in terms of how to assess that kind of payment in just a moment. Three, you have to pay ripui. You have to pay for the doctor's bills. Four, you have to pay shevis. You have to pay for disability. In other words, now he can't work as a result of the fact that you harmed him. So you have to pay for that as well. Again, we're going to give a formula for how to assess Shevis. And finally, number five, Boshes, you have to pay for the embarrassment that was suffered as a result of the fact that you damaged him. And again, we're going to give some sort of formula to assess how you're going to pay for the embarrassment. Beneza Ketzad. So here we have the Mishnah taking us step by step in terms of the formula for how to assess these damages. So Ketzad Simaseno Katas Yado. So let's say you either blinded out one of his eyes or You cut off one of his hands, Shibur is Ragla, or you broke his hand. Rono so ki'ilu hu evan nimka b'shuk. You look at him as if he was a slave sold on the market. V'shamen kama hu yafe, kama haya yafe, v'kama hu yafe. And then the differential between how much he was worth versus how much he's worth right now, and you pay for that differential. Okay. Here comes an interesting point. Rashi over here writes that we look at him as if he was sold in the market as an eved. The Mishnah doesn't tell us what kind of eved. Rashi writes over here as if he were sold as an eved ivri. It's an interesting Rashi. Right. It's an interesting Rashi. Now, on one hand, I understand why Rashi says eved ivri, because we're talking about a Jew. Right? A Jew is not an eved kanani. A Jew cannot become an eved kanani. So in terms of the market value, so since he's a Jew, so Rashi says, how he sold as an Eved Ivri. That's why Rashi said Eved Ivri. However, as Ben points out, as I'm about to point out myself, this is strange because an Eved Ivri is not sold as a market commodity. An Eved Ivri is an indentured servant. So an Eved Ivri will be sold in terms of his work value. But we're not actually assessing his actual value. That's in terms of an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani is assessed. So it's very possible that you could have explained the Mishnah that even though he's a Jew, we're obviously not selling him as an Eved Kanani, but in terms of assessing the damage, we'll use the Eved Kanani model in terms of realizing what the actual loss was. That's the way you could have said it. In fact, other Rishonim do say it that way. But just an interesting Rashi, where Rashi says that we're talking about him in terms of him being an Eved Ivri, not an Eved Kanani. Continuing. The Tsar, pain. Now, what is the formula for the assessment of pain? So, Kavo B'Shmuro B'Mismar. let's say you stuck somebody with a poker or a nail, the afilo al tziparno, and even if you do so on the person's fingernail, makom she'eino sechabura, a place where there's not going to be any permanent damage, but it hurts like anything. So right now, I'm going to say the Mishnah very simply, but when we do the Gemara later on, we'll have a better understanding of this formula, basically how much a person would pay not to have this pain. That's a simple way to say the Mishnah. When we get to the Gemara later on, tomorrow, or I believe the day after, we'll give a more detailed explanation of how this formula works. Ripui. Hikau chavler foso. If you hurt somebody, so you have to pay for the doctor bill. That's easy. This is an easy formula. Whatever the doctor bills, that's what you pay. Now, what if there is additional medical attention that he needs as a result of your wound? So you have to pay those bills as well. So in other words, not only do you have to pay the original medical bill, but if there is additional medical attention that is as a result of your wound, you're on the hook for that as well.
Some sort of
rehab, or just a simple developmental problems that came as a result of it. Yeah, like rehab. So chaisa v'nistra chayla refoso. Chaisa kol tzarcho in chayla refoso. If let's say you send him to the doctor, he gets a partial healing but not a full healing, you will be continuously on the hook until he has a full refuah, until he has a full healing. And then if afterwards he has a relapse, so it sounds like from the Mishnah, once he has a full healing, so then you're not responsible for the relapse. Sheves, disability. So basically, again, we'll talk more in detail about this formula, but you look at what he currently can do versus what he previously could do, and you have to pay that differential, and that's a disability. And finally, boshes, in terms of embarrassment. This one is going to be the hardest one to try to put in some sort of monetary definition of this is the embarrassment that you have to pay. So the Gemara, the Mishnah says, embarrassment is relative, and the Mishnah is acknowledging that very point. In fact, if you take a look at Rashi over here, Rashi writes, Adam Chashav and his Baish Bushasom Meruba, when you have somebody who's an Adam Chashav, he's a significant person, and he got embarrassed, so for him, embarrassment is going to be greater than somebody who was on a quote unquote lower level. Again, even with the Rashi, it's hard to give it. You'll remember earlier in the Gemara occasionally gives us like some form of schedule of, you know, you slap somebody in the face, so they pay this much. So there was some sort of menu, if you will, in terms of identifying how much you should pay for the boshes aspect. Okay, much more to discuss on all five of these categories. That's why we're learning the eighth parak together. We're going to do so. Let's just quickly start the Gemara. The Gemara over here, we'll start it, and we'll obviously we'll continue tomorrow. Gemara over here is going to be tackling a very simple question, and that is, how do I know all this? I poke out my friend's eye. I have to pay him. That's not what the Torah says. The Torah says, ayin tachas ayin. That if I poke out my friend's eye, so then as compensation, he can go ahead and poke out my eye. And in the Torah, what you walk away from after reading the Torah, the simple pshat in the Torah, is that you don't pay for the damage. You actually get what you gave. So this is what the Gemara is going to open up as a simple discussion. It's not a simple discussion. In fact, this Gemara that we're about to start right now is going to continue into tomorrow's daf and basically take us through most of tomorrow's daf as well. How do I know that ayin tachas ayin means money? So amai ayin tachas ayin amar achmana ima ayin mamish. So lo sakadatcha. So the Gemara says, let's not even entertain that as a havamina, that the Torah means eye for eye, literally detanya. We learned in a bright. I might have thought that measure for measure, like the Torah says, So the Gemara says that the Torah puts side by side the damage inflicted on an animal and the damage inflicted on a person. Now, by an animal, we're definitely not going to go measure for measure. Their compensation is in the form of money, so too when I damage my friend. And the Gemara says, now, if the Brisa says, if you don't like that, I'll give you something else to consider. You know that you can't pay ransom if you kill somebody. If you killed somebody, there is one occasion where you're allowed to pay ransom, and that is if your animal, which is a mu'ad, kills a person. But outside of that, there is no ransom for the wrongful death of somebody. If you're responsible for somebody's death, there's no ransom. You do not allow him to pay his way out. Which implies, says the Gemara, that if it's not murder, but it's just damage, and even though it's permanent damage, but you didn't kill the person, so there is kofar, there's a way of paying your way out, and that is another source in the Torah that speaks to this idea that when you damage somebody, there's a form of compensation. Okay, let's pause over here. The Gemara is going to continue just discussing this point again and again. And basically, for the rest of today's daf and tomorrow's daf, we're going to be addressing the very simple question of, hey, the Torah says ayin tachas ayin, and how do we know that that turns into monetary payment? It really touches on some very basic issues of Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichsav, and the relationship between the two. Stop over here.